very much.
Good morning.
Good morning. That's okay. Sure. So it's a pleasure to be here this morning and to enjoy this service with all of you. And I want to especially thank the Taylors and Deb Ward who issued the invitation. As you've heard, I work as a hospital chaplain. I was a Unitarian Universalist minister for many years, and I now work as a hospital chaplain, and I've become a Buddhist. And both of these involve more listening than talking. And I'm a pretty big talker, and sometimes I miss the discipline of writing a sermon, so I am very appreciative of the opportunity to be here with all of you this morning. UU minister and poet Barbara Peskin, who's also my partner, wrote this. He would not speak of death, banned all talk of it, but one day, standing at a window, white-haired, elegant, composed, looking out at the yard, at the chair near the hedge where on soft afternoons he sat in the sun. Yesterday I was thinking, what's the use? And then from inside the hedge, a bird hopped out to the end of the twig, perched a long time looking at me, and then flew away over my head. And then this came to me, but oh, it's all so beautiful. His voice, only a little softer than usual, amazing him in acknowledging so much, he turned from the window and sat down. I wish I could say I said nothing more. No, I said too much and was not asked back and did not see him again until on his deathbed he could not uninvite me from the silent watch I had taken up. But I keep seeing over and over again the bird and the man regarding each other and flying away. When I ask you to think about beauty, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Maybe it's something from the natural world, say the beauty of the snow on the bluffs, or an eagle riding thermals in the summer months. Or maybe it's an instance of human beauty, like your baby granddaughter's first smile, or perhaps the achingly beautiful trio from the end of Der Rosenkavalier, or an elegant mathematical proof, perhaps, or some lines from Shakespeare or Tagore or Basho. Or have you just recalled an argument you had with someone over beauty, you finding something utterly lovely and your opponent thinks it's ugly? Or maybe your first thoughts were tainted by the beauty industry, and for a moment, imagining yourself in front of a mirror, you identify ways in which you do not measure up. Or as the man says in the poem, an inexplicable moment that sings the fullness of life into the maw of your despair. I experience, or it seems that the experience of beauty engages us body and feelings or emotions and our mind. There is a surprise, a sudden perception of something that is beautiful, and it might cause a sharp intake of breath and a feeling of warmth in the heart, and the mind expands with appreciation. I'm mostly attuned to the beauty in music, and if I hear something that strikes me as really beautiful, no matter where I am, I will cry. So I wonder, if you were to write a sermon, give a sermon on beauty today, what would you talk about? And you'll get a chance to share that with all of us in a little bit. A few weeks ago, I was watching a nature program on public television. It was about birds of paradise in Papua New Guinea. There are 42 species of them. The announcer tells us that the food has always been so plentiful and so easily gathered that males have been left free to develop their powers of attraction. They have dazzling plumage and interesting dances. I'm guessing they experience them as beautiful. All to win a female to mate with. These fellows have evolved iridescent patches of plumage, blues, greens, and they have, some of them have the ability to fan out their feathers around their neck to make like a complete circle or a ruff, or they can do that with their wings or tail feathers. And some dance on the ground, some dance on a tree branch, some dance hanging backwards, hanging down. Each has a way to dance that shows off his plumage to best advantage. Now the female, for her part, is dressed in utilitarian colors. She watches, she inspects, and in a final reckoning, either presents herself or flies away. And ladies, I feel the need to digress and point out the obvious, that our species has taken an evolutionary wrong turn. In other species, it is the male whose job it is to dress up, put on high heels, put on makeup, dance like Fred Astaire, bat his eyelashes in hopes of scoring. It is our job to wear beige and dish. But we're never meant to bind our feet in high heels, nor were we meant to be standing for hours in front of a mirror burning our scalps with a curling iron. Gentlemen, step up. It would be an intriguing idea for a sermon to track the evolution of beauty from these plant and animal displays that are designed by their genes to perpetuate themselves, and that by the time we sit here in this room have evolved to be music and art and dance, all of which you are going to explore over the next few weeks. Might say beauty for beauty's sake. In a random Google search, I came across a perfect 20-minute TED Talk by a philosopher of art whose name is Dennis Dutton. And his presentation, which really is brilliant, I encourage you to see it. His presentation is a Darwinian theory of beauty. He does a lovely job of following the evolution of display and attraction to the human experience of and our predilection for beauty. But I finally settled on the experience of beauty as the fruition of spiritual practice or spiritual path. As we grow spiritually, we increase our capacity to experience beauty in all of the moments of life. As the old man said, as he was considering his approaching death, it's all so beautiful. Now, I'm looking through a Buddhist lens this morning, but I don't think you'll find it too alien from Unitarian Universalist perspective. What did Buddha do when he achieved enlightenment, which means being fully present and aware moment by moment? He achieved this through the practice of meditation. He tamed his wild mind so that he could be simply present now and now and now. He learned to relax his mind and become aware of the things as they are, without adding anything to the experience. That is, no conceptual overlay, no further evaluation, no explanations, no comparing and contrasting, no liking and disliking, no narrative. He's a prince from northeastern India who lived 2,500 years ago, and he was a human being just as we are. And he became the Buddha, which means the one who has awakened. The meditative powers that he developed lie nascent in each of us, in you and in me, waiting to be developed, and indeed it is our birthright to be able to do so. The practice of meditation that the Buddha taught is called mindfulness awareness meditation, and it is still taught and practiced today. Probably some of you practice it. But it's a training, as I said, for the mind to relax itself so that it's not so busy, so that it's more resting in one place. But it also trains us to cultivate warmth and curiosity about our minds so that we see ourselves and in action, you could say. So we see ourselves in action. And as our mindfulness grows stronger, we are able to stay present moment by moment, open and aware of whatever arises, either in the world or within our own minds. And as our warmth and curiosity grows and deepens, we feel more, we receive, we experience more and more of what comes to us that we call experience. We are not so involved with trying to hang on to what's the pleasurable stuff and to get rid of the painful stuff. We're less afraid, we're more curious, we're less judgmental, and we feel more warmth toward ourselves and toward others and toward our world. Neuroscience confirms what accomplished meditators have observed generation after generation for at least 2,000 years. And there isn't really a time to go into the neuroscience, but generally human cognition works by a lot of comparing and generalizing. Four legs supporting a flat surface, perhaps with a perpendicular flat surface rising from one of the four sides, equals a chair. And once we have the abstract label, we are much less likely to see the details that distinguish this chair in this moment. We are much less likely to experience the feeling tones and the shades of a particular perception. For example, we see a chair today in front of a window that reveals an overcast and gray day and dull light, and we say it's a chair. And tomorrow when we see it bathed in the warm sunlight pouring through that same window, the sunlight drawing out its rich walnut tones and warming the whole room, we think of it as the same chair. The Buddha's awareness would take in the whole of each of these moments of perception, foreground, background, noting all of the details that come together in this particular moment, never to come together exactly in the same way again. And by the way, there, to some extent, animals do this. Generalizations and categories don't stir the heart to reveal beauty, and the fullness of a particular moment of perception stirs us to experience beauty. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche is a Tibetan meditation master who founded the lineage of Buddhism that I practice. Once when Trungpa and some of his students were taking a road trip across Nova Scotia, he took along his camera, and one of his students tells this story. One afternoon while we were driving on the north shore of the province, we took a dirt road down a tiny fishing pier, which a batter sign proclaimed was McDonald's Cove. It was a gray day, the water and the sky both appearing dull and dirty to me. We looked at the water and at the lobster traps on the pier and talked to a few fishermen. Rinpoche casually snapped some pictures. A few weeks later, when I saw the slides from that afternoon, I was particularly struck by his shots of water, by the luminous quality of these photographs and the nuances of color, form, light that he had captured. I realized that he and I were seeing very differently when we looked at the same things. I could feel wonder and depth and delight in his pictures as compared with the monotony and the dismal tones of my own memories of that day. There's a term in Buddhism that describes this experience of someone who is pretty awake. And remember that being awake is being present and aware moment by moment, without adding anything to that experience. The term is called one taste. Whatever one experiences, good, bad, happy, sad, friend, foe, comfortable, dangerous, one experiences it fully. No grasping some experiences and pushing away or avoiding others. No ignoring, simply tasting fully. Moments experienced in depth and fullness transcend our categories of pleasure and pain, wanting and not wanting. And another way of saying this is that everything is experienced as one taste. or no picking and choosing. Now, beauty's origins, I suspect, lie in picking and choosing. Our genes develop grand strategies to perpetuate themselves, but evolution adds layers of complexity and meaning. There's a Unitarian process philosopher, Charles Hartshorne, who was also an amateur ornithologist, and he was convinced that birds sing for the sheer joy of it. What begins as an elaborate process of picking and choosing becomes beauty for beauty's sake, and from there opens the transcendent, the experience that transcends picking and choosing. What begins as a process of attraction and by implication, rejection, continues and flourishes. And ultimately, we discover in ourselves the capacity to experience beauty in everything, to love everything, to open ourselves to the simple experience of being alive moment by moment without picking and choosing. We have the capacity to come awake to a rich, luminous, joyous flow of moments, all so beautiful. The experience of beauty that transcends picking and choosing is a sign of spiritual accomplishment. Now, I think this spiritual accomplishment can come through spiritual disciplines like meditation practice. I think for many of us it comes as we grow older and we have no choice but to relax a little bit. And it also comes, sneaks up upon us, whether we beckon it or not, and sometimes takes us by surprise and completely opens up our world. However it comes, it is a sign of spiritual accomplishment, which is an ever-opening heart and mind, an ever-expanding embrace of life and its fullness, an ever-deepening sense of wonder. It is to be alive in an atmosphere of grace and gratitude. It's all so beautiful. Thanks. So, is this where we talk? I used to work in a fellowship that had a conversation after the sermon. And it was my experience that whatever I had to say was always a small piece of pie. And when people began sharing out of their own experience, we would have this huge, complex, beautiful web of experience and meaning. So, it's your turn to share your thoughts or experiences. Please.
53 and a half years ago, my first year in college, I was playing touch football in gym class, and there was a man who was so positive, so inclusive, and so enthusiastic. We became friends on that day, and 2.5 years later, we were brothers in Death of a Salesman, and now in the last few weeks, I've been communicating with him, and he's, because we're going to put on some scenes from that again at our 50th college reunion. And he's still the same. He's full of positive hope and inclusiveness, and it's a beautiful thing.
Exactly. Please.
I'm struck with the beauty, the ever-expanding beauty of connection with all critters, all life, all things on this earth and the universe. And that has just been something that I've been real present with the last couple of years in particular. And as I study quantum theory and astrophysics, as a very humble student, by the way, I just become even more amazed at the beauty in the universe.
Yeah. Yeah, and as you're, I'm imagining that as your connections deepen as your understanding expands, it's ever more dazzling and beautiful.
Yes, and what I notice is that all systems of thought, as they evolve, meet at some point.
My mother had this incredible ability to just be in the moment. And I've noticed since she's passed away that, you know, she was so in the moment that it sometimes was almost like she wasn't even there. Because the moment was all about all of the things that were around her. And it's odd because now that she is gone, it's almost like she's still there in that same way.
Yes. Please.
I really enjoyed what you said, and I'm really compelling. It's just a compelling interest to me. But and rather than say anything myself, I would like to listen again and try to understand better what you're getting at with this question of picking and choosing our experience.
Okay.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that, or even go back to where you were.
Yeah.
Because that's just such a a remarkable thought.
Yeah, picking and choosing. The phrase one taste pops up sometimes in Buddhism to describe the experience of experiencing everything. The great meditation masters and the Buddha himself taught that we can experience anything, including our own death, which means that there's some larger mind of which we are a kind of a bud in this time. But that what keeps us from being fully aware and present is this activity of picking and choosing. And we do it, I mean, you begin to see this in meditation, or if you're just watching yourself, like there is this ongoing narrative that is just running nonstop through every moment. And it's like, I'm attracted to this, that sucks, keep it away from me. Oh, that's dangerous, I'm scared to death of that. Oh, that's really good, I want to hold on to it. No, I want to let go. Just blah, 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 blah. And so a Zen way of pointing to that activity of our very busy, untrained mind is to say picking and choosing. And the teaching is no picking and choosing. So it's just amazing to watch yourself, and you don't even have to practice meditation, but watch yourself. I moved here from Chicago, so the great example is always traffic. Watch yourself. I don't imagine you quite grasp the experience of going 1 mile in a half an hour. But watch yourself in any kind of situation. It could be a positive one or a negative one, and just listen to how you talk to yourself. And the more you listen, the more you discover that there's just this ongoing assessment, this ongoing evaluation, this ongoing trying to control our every environment so that we're always comfortable, and we always get what we want, and we don't have to get anything we don't want. And that activity is picking and choosing. And so what the Buddha taught, and I don't think this is, in this sense, is unique to Buddhism, because I think you were talking about all systems of thought, and I'm guessing all spiritualities meet at some point. And I think that point is being fully present and awake and accepting in the world in such a way that you're just with it. And there's something, I don't know, some of it's hard to describe, because if you're not in the middle of the experience, it sounds like platitudes or, you know, banal, stupid things. I was thinking about a good death, you know, which is not something you can instruct someone to have, but death is something we don't want to lose anyone. Most of us are probably frightened of our own death. And so the thought that there could be a process by which one person is leaving this world and the people, the loved ones, are gathered around, and it's possible mentally and emotionally and spiritually for this death to happen, for the dying person to let go, for the living people to let go and feel the way, ultimately, that they're still with us. But to have there be some sense of peace and even beauty in that whole experience. So that's what I'm getting at, that if we stop picking and choosing, we're going to find ourselves compelled by many moments. I'll stop babbling now. So you had a question, I think, in the black shirt. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, I love seeing our three-year-old have sort of spontaneous joy and recognition of beauty. He'll look out in the backyard, and maybe he's just picked this up from us, but he'll say, "Isn't it beautiful, Mama?"
Yeah.
And so that's just, it's always great to be brought back into the present moment with him.
Yeah, just... There's a, I don't know when, there was a Unitarian Universalist minister, Clark Dewey Wells, who was a wonderful poet and a kind of a larger-than-life figure, and he wrote a series of, some of his works got published, and there was one where he talks, I think it's one of his Christmas writings, and he talks about being in, reading a paper, or working on a sermon, or whatever, something, and his little kid's trying to get his attention, and finally he drags him outside and says, "You be glad at that star." So, yeah, please.
I appreciated your words, and I was especially struck by, I forget exactly how you said it, but how the need to relax and observe more and try to control less is sometimes imposed on us by age or illness or things mm-hmm. like that. I would think as a chaplain, you see that a lot, not just with death, but I had surgery yeah. a little over a year ago, and Stephen had surgery not too long ago. You know, it's not something I ever would have chosen, and yet it was a real gift in terms of sort of being forced to relax and just observe and say, okay, where am I and what's happening? And, mm-hmm. As I get, you know, move away from that, I think, okay, how can I pretend I'm in the hospital again without going? It does take some sort of spiritual discipline, whether it's meditation or other forms, to impose that on ourselves, because our jobs and our families' obligations and community obligations don't. It's sort of against our culture to just sit and not do anything.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how? Yeah. I just how do we do that?
Yeah.
How,
don't how just do something. Be there. Yeah.
I would add to that we have this idea that we need to do. Mm-hmm. How much are we doing? We're so distracted all the time. Mm-hmm. It's like we're never really anywhere because we've sort of outsourced all of our parts so that we're not really there at all.
I felt really vindicated that there was some research that revealed that multitasking and something young people do, you know, with the headphones and the homework and the texting and all that, that they're really not doing very well on anything. Because there's another, neuroscience has confirmed it, but so does meditation. Your mind only does one thing at once. It jumps around, but it's not like it's completely focused on texting and all of that. So, and it is, you know, I think we are so adapted now to wanting it all and thinking we have to do and have it all that in the beginning you have to take some time and really narrow down your world to meditate or to do Tai Chi or, you know, do yoga or do whatever your discipline is. And you have to be very intentional, but as your mind adapts to this capacity that it has, then you find that when you're washing the dishes, you're washing the dishes. When you're with your two-year-old, you're with your two-year-old. When you're whatever you're doing, you're not distracted because the blah, 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 and your mind isn't so much leading a life of its own and trying to pull you along. You're just gathered and there. And you have more time, and it's more fun, apparently. Yes.
I'm curious, could you speak a bit about how you bring this practice you have to your work as a chaplain at Henderson and some of
Well, I think probably, I think what happens is that I'm more likely, you know, on my best days, I'm sort of calm and present in different situations. So if there's a lot of, if folks are really worked, I mean, if there's a crisis going on and people are really worked up, there's something about my presence which calms. I mean, it's not an activity, it's just sort of something in the atmosphere. And the real challenge for me, I mean, I am a blabbermouth. When I was invited to an Indian-themed birthday party as a three-year-old, my invitation came to babbling Brooke Tyndall, and it really, you know, I'm 62 now, and it ain't changed much. But, so for me, it's really, sometimes it's a challenge to just shut up and be with people, and just, but it's a matter, I think there's something, I don't think it's magic, and it doesn't necessarily have to come out of meditation practice, but just being with somebody, being present, and sort of receiving allows them to share more of what's going on with them. It allows me to see more of a full human being and get, you know, I imagine I could have this kind of conversation with Newt Gingrich, you know, that he's mostly a category in my mind, but I'm imagining that I could have a conversation with him in which he would become full and multidimensional. And I think it, and I guess the final thing about the practice is that in Buddhism, in Unitarian Universalism, we talk about the inherent worth and dignity of all people. We point to some core of goodness. In Buddhism, it's called Buddha nature. In Shambhala Buddhism, which I practice, it's called basic goodness. So there's also a sense of whatever's going on with this person, and it can be pretty, sometimes pretty awful, that there's some depth of basic goodness there. And that it's possible for us to connect out of that. So that they're not the sum of the injuries done to them or the surgeries and losses they're experiencing. Yes. Oh, but let me, there's somebody behind you who hasn't had one yet, and then you can be next, though, okay?
Especially these times, thinking about Martin Luther King, I realize that beauty helps us to rise above everyday experience and politics even. You know, here was a guy who thought back in very, very troubled times about intuitively knew and preached that we were all related. And, you know, it was hard to believe at the time. But now, 40 years later, and the unfolding of genomics and DNA, we know that what he preached about was absolutely scientifically correct, that, you know, all this beautiful diversity of the human species came from one place, from one parentage in East Africa, and how, while we're all diverse and beautifully diverse, we're all related. And that, to me, is just something that guides my everyday life and even, you know, political thoughts. I mean, it's just an incredible truth that MLK had way back then in trouble times.
Exactly. Thank you. I'm guessing we've got time for maybe one more. Yeah. Who would like have the last word, please?
I don't have to have the last word. Somebody wants to have the last word. Go ahead. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, those are brilliant final words. Walk in beauty. Thank you. Thank you.
Please stand as you are able while we sing hymn number 94.